So the idea is, once we identify a cause, we bring people who are interested in contributing to it to come and participate in it. Not just monetarily, but to actually give their mind space and, you know, bring together a collective intent to make it happen. So that would mean whoever, if a participating person is a lawyer, they would help us in structuring the collective. If they're an engineer, they would help us build the check dams and bridges and so on. They can participate in whatever way they can.
Hello and welcome to the Startup Operator Podcast. I'm Roshan Karyappa. I have this fantasy, like maybe some of you have, of someday living in a farm with a few of my friends as neighbors, being close to nature, growing my own food, and staying away from the hustle and bustle of the city. Sunit Reddy is making this possible with BeForest, where he builds forest collectives for like-minded people interested in sustainable living. Sunit graduated in computer science from IIT Madras and, like perhaps others in his batch, built a stellar career in tech and finance before starting BeForest. On this podcast, we delve into how Sunit is building these collectives, being a for-profit and for-good venture, defining a core culture, building a community, and operating in a niche space. This was a fascinating conversation, and I hope you like it. Hey, Sunit, welcome to the Startup Operator Podcast. Thank you so much for making the time.
Hi, Roshan. Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah. Sunit, like I mentioned, you know, BeForest is such an interesting concept. We don't really have too many entrepreneurs in this space, and I certainly haven't spoken to anyone on the podcast who's doing what you do. But, you know, to begin things, how do you go from being a tech guy to building sustainable properties, right? What caused this change and what has the transition been like?
See, I mean, growing up, I think I was always fascinated by simple living. Probably it's got to do with a lot of, you know, Ruskin Bonds and the Roald Dahls of the world. But there's always been a pleasure that I've experienced in, you know, the simple things like having a chai on a swing or something like that. And as I've grown in this corporate career also, that part of me was always active as a hobby though. So I've dabbled in several things. And what really got me interested is the fact that wherever there was some kind of a conservation effort, it need not be an ecological conservation also, wherever, even cultural preservation, whatever it is, where you're trying to preserve things. It focused more on a charity kind of a thing. You know, it wasn't, there was the very few models that we came across where business viability was also important on a large scale. And that sort, that problem sort of fascinated us, and we iterated through different things. And as we got deeper and deeper into how do we build a model around ecological preservation, because I was primarily a wildlife enthusiast as well, what we realized is, you know, the problems were sounding really complex, but the solutions were really simple. And most of the times it was resulting in, you know, you just had to revert back to what you have been doing 50 years ago. And that was the theme. And a small, simple triggers like, you know, farmer crisis, an entire generation that felt that farming was not really, you know, viable or not a first career choice. And we sort of started looking at this. And as we got deeper and deeper, we got more excited by the problem. And eventually we sort of took it up full time.
Right. So what was that process like? You know, I mean, did you take a step back and say, hey, this is the entire, you know, agri market, and this is a niche that probably I could operate in? I mean, if you can take us through the steps, right? I mean, that could be useful for someone else who is perhaps considering something similar.
Yeah, I mean, see, the thing was, it came up organically. I don't think we went through the traditional route of, you know, finding a total addressable market and, you know, all of that. But the interesting thing about this was, I was always a techie, right? Like you mentioned. So my solution to making farming easier, the first thought that came up in my mind was, why don't we automate everything? So, and I wanted to remove the human being out of it. And that tendency probably came up because I used to be an algorithmic trader as well. So my thought process was, if you can remove a human being from something as complex as trading, then why not from farming as well? And slowly, you know, as we tried experimenting with it, in a lot of places, we sort of realized that technology was being an overkill. Where we didn't need it, we were using it for the heck of it. And the same solution could have been done in a natural way also. For example, if you just wanted to get more water efficient, a much easier way to do it was to create a lot of diversity and increase the soil carbon and a couple of metrics that change the water scenario dramatically on a farm. Rather than, you know, trying to use very advanced irrigation mechanisms or sensors and stuff like that, right? So as we went down that road, shifting everything to a natural behavior, end of the day, we realized that if we could spend some time revitalizing the soil itself and trying to increase its capacity to hold water, most problems were being solved. So it almost was like we set out to solve problem A, B, and C, and we ended up finding a solution for X, Y, Z. And so that's typically how it happened. So we started experimenting with a few friends part-time. And in that first 1 year, when we didn't put any pressure on the farm itself, we saw that the kind of transformation that was possible. We went from an area that was considered unfit for agriculture to having enough water to survive in summer as well. So now that transformation, if it could happen in 1 year, we knew we had an idea that was worth scaling up. And coming from Hyderabad and the south, where everybody wants it, people are tired of the urban sprawl and they want the most sought after way of connecting with nature is really to own a farm. We thought this is the best way of actually running a farm. So that's when we came up with this concept of a collective where, we just put a shout out there saying, we have this idea that we can actually make a farm work like a forest. You will still get food. Most likely, you'll get a lot more food than your conventional farming. And we are ready to run it for a period of 10, 15 years. Who's willing to participate? And that's really how our first collective started off.
Right. In one of our episodes, I was talking to an agri-tech founder and he said, when we approached the farmers, it was surprising that they were already using AI. They were using ancestral intelligence, right? So I was reminded of that. But just another contrast to your previous life and what you're doing right now, technology is inherently scalable, right? It's a bits and bytes business. You can ship once and serve, many million customers. Whereas what you're doing right now, it seems like such a finite sort of a landscape, right? A collective, you kind of inherently limit the number of people who can participate in this. These seem like two very different worlds, How did you adjust to this mindset?
Honestly, the idea of a collective, it's not that we have set out to do collectives only. The idea of the collective was to be a prototype. See, if I walk into a village and give my gyan as a city dweller, nobody is going to listen to me. I could profess all the theory. Nobody's going to listen unless they see it in practice. And the beauty of it is we saw it happening in practice. Where that first experiment that I was talking about, for the first year, from extreme skepticism, people moved on to, hey, show me how to do it as well, even I want to do it. So when an entire village begins to adopt something that they trashed away a year ago, we realized that, okay, all we have to do now is to set up these prototypes in different landscapes. And if we do well enough, if we solve those problems of everyday farming, then the rest of the place also starts adopting the same principle. So even on a sustainability scale, we're very clear that, whether it's 100 acre or 500 acres farm also, while as a farm, it may be large, it doesn't do anything to tilt the balance, right? It has to happen at a landscape level beyond the scope of a single individual or a group of individuals. It has to be adopted en masse. And that's only possible if you're able to sort of open source the way to do it along with a proof of concept. And that's how we looked at it. And it's the first signs are beginning to show also. Like Coorg is a great example, in fact. Most of our neighbors were growing 20 times, 30 times the amount of coffee that we were growing when we started out in 2019. That has changed to maybe 10 times now. But what is really surprising is most of them are willing to adopt these processes now. Quite a few of our neighbors have asked us, what is it that you guys are doing? Because it's very uncanny for them that we are deploying so much in infrastructure. So they sort of do this mental math that, okay, they probably are making money. So how come? They're not even growing 30 bags an acre. How come? How are they doing it? That curiosity has sparked and it will sort of translate to adoption also.
Right. I know we've hinted at it, but what is BeeForest today? And if you can explain the concept a little more for our listeners.
So BeeForest is a company that sets up sustainable landscapes in areas where we feel there is ecological and cultural significance. What we mean by that is we identify places where we think if we show up a way forward to some common day-to-day farm problems, there is going to be a large-scale impact. And we've selected our landscapes in that way. Currently, we operate in Coorg, Hyderabad and Bombay. And we're looking to scale up more in South and Central India. And so the idea is, once we identify a cause, we bring people who are interested in contributing to it to come and participate in it. Not just monetarily, but to actually give their mind space and, you know, bring together a collective intent to make it happen. So that would mean whoever, if a participating person is a lawyer, they would help us in structuring the collective. If they're an engineer, they would help us build the check dams and bridges and so on. So wherever, however they can participate, they don't have to come and dig a pit in the farm itself, but they can participate in whatever way they can. Those who have that intent to move towards a sustainable life, we are sort of becoming a platform for them to make it happen.
Right. I'd love to understand, you know, what goes into building a collective, right? But before that, you're operating in sort of a nascent space. There is no precedence to what you're doing. Really, there is no competition in some sense, right? At least an apples to apples comparison. How do you operate in this space when, you know, you are kind of setting the benchmarks for what is possible and literally everything is through first principles and you're communicating a new concept to every kind of stakeholder that you're talking to? How do you operate? What are some, you know, operating principles for such a situation?
So the way we see it, it's not like we're inventing something new. Different folks have implemented different smaller parts of this entire design in several places across the country on a much smaller scale. So in that sense, we are playing a director of sorts, bringing different actors to the same table and creating a much larger canvas. So in that sense, we call ourselves enablers of intent. That's why, where, you know, we are not coming up with a product. We are really just getting, if someone knows how to grow dryland rice, we bring them to work on Hyderabad, which is a drier landscape. If someone knows how to build structures from earth which tolerate heavy monsoons, we use them. So we have this, built this entire ecosystem of contributors whom we are directing towards a common agenda. But having said that, yes, you're right in the sense that we are often compared to, for lack of a better word, we are put in a real estate bucket sometimes. Sometimes we are compared to, say, an organic farm and asked what is so different about this. And it takes a lot of education and a lot of content and examples that we have to show. It's much easier now because we actually have working concepts, things that are translated from thought to reality. But in the early days, it required a lot of putting my neck on the line and saying, you know what, this can happen. This has happened. I'm right here. You know where I live. Please trust me with this. So that sort of putting my personal credibility on the line and having face-to-face conversations. I think our first collective, our first community of 20-25 members came out of me and my co-founder talking to at least 500 different people for hours at a stretch, having very deep conversations about what they want to do, how we can help them, how this makes much more sense. And at the end of it, yeah, it always came down to, can they trust me? The trust played a very big role, I feel.
Yeah. No, that's a very important point that you mentioned. And I think it's applicable across, you know, multiple domains as well, right? In some sense, the founder has to live the problem and the solution, and sort of evangelize it themselves to gain any kind of adoption. Now, if I were to poll, you know, the random person on the road, right, likely that, you know, people will say that they care about sustainability. But here you're talking about caring about sustainability by literally uprooting yourself from whatever, you know, wherever you're living, whatever you're doing, to kind of imbibing a new way of life itself, right? How do you get people to do that?
You know what? So that's the interesting bit. We don't actually get people to do that. They're already looking to do it. And people find us. So that's what has been the counterintuitive thing about this whole company, right? Is it was really something catering to 10 or 15 of us coming together and trying something. But when the word of mouth spreads, there are so many people looking forward to do this. Of course, when I say so many, I'm not talking about thousands or tens of thousands. Like every collective we do really needs 50, 60 people in that city, right, to adopt. And I believe that set of 50-60 always exists. And if they find us at the right time, there's no one else doing it either. There's no one else giving that avenue to move towards sustainability. But having said that, I think a lot of it, initial adopters also, including us, we came from very romantic notions and about living on a farm. And of course, we thought it'll mostly be working from a farm really means, like, you know, dipping your feet in the lake and typing away on a laptop or something like that. But it's really not that. Most of the times you're worried about, you know, leaking plumbing lines and stuff like that. But then, you know, that's what it is, right? That's where BeForest really plays a role, where we don't want our members to worry about these same things. We are the man on the ground. We'll take care of those things. And you can participate in your capacity as and when time allows. As we moved from year zero to year one, when things started getting real, our Pumale Collective, our guest house is getting ready. It's about to open in about 15 days time, where members can actually go and stay there until their houses are done. When things became real is when we started actually addressing these real world issues of, okay, if I come and live there, what about internet? What's the closest medical facility? Where do my kids go to school? So by virtue of wanting our members to participate, we have ended up close to a city. So it was easy to solve. Of course, Coorg is far off, but there also we've managed to create a high bandwidth internet connectivity, telephone connections and all of that. But Hyderabad and Bombay are within touching distance. Like, people can actually even think of it as a first home, especially in the tech space.
Right. I know we've spoken about a collective, you know, multiple times on the podcast already. It has a certain significance, right? When you talk about it from a BeForest perspective, what is a collective and what goes into building a BeForest collective?
A collective is a nice word we have coined and it sort of reflects what we want to do. We want to make sure that there is a group of people who have a common goal. And they are together trying to address a problem in the best way it can be done. And when we were thinking about what kind of name really captures it all, I think we heard of Timbuktu Collective somewhere, and that's where we figured out, okay, this word really suits us a lot. So we invented this thing called collective farming. But having said that, see, what does it take to create a collective is, I think, being able to articulate our idea of sustainability before you get into the whole process of buying land and, you know, creating a plan, not the traditional real estate way of doing things where, you know, you present what do you see when you walk into a farmhouse project or something, right? You see a giant map with different plots and stuff. We are not talking like that. We really are focusing on the intent. And the greatest filter of that is when we go ahead and say, you know, we don't know where the farm is. We don't know how big it's going to be, but here's what we are trying to do. We are trying to stay somewhere within 90 minutes of a city, probably 100 acres or so. And we'll try to stick it closer to a one bedroom or a two bedroom apartment in the city. And with these concepts, we'll try to make it work like a forest, a true permaculture landscape, all these different ideas, being able to articulate it and putting down a framework of how we are going to operate, which inspires trust in the listener as well. So I think that's something we've really mastered. Of course, the three collectives have helped us fine tune our process also. But that, I think those initial conversations, which take a lot of patience, a lot of courage also to say no to something. It's very tempting to accept anyone and everyone who comes forward. But to really realize the vision in the long term, we feel we need the people who have that single point agenda of making this vision come to reality. So we say no to a lot of folks whom we think don't fit into this group, establishing the value systems, not compromising on them, most importantly. I think all of these put together, it sort of filters out a community. And then the rest of it is really framework. And we are really inspired by this theory that we have put to practice also, which is the theory of inspired action, which basically talks about when you come across a trigger, an external factor and your felt need, you have this light bulb moment where you think, okay, I can do this too. How about doing it this way, or some solution to a problem? And if there are enough triggers, that one time thought translates into what we call as inspiration, where you're actually thinking about it repeatedly and it's getting more and more fine-tuned in your head. Now, if that fizzles out, it doesn't mean anything. But if you have a platform where that inspiration can lead to an action, that inspired action has a lot more effect than, you know, randomly doing something. So this whole process of illumination, the light bulb moment, to the evocation, inspiration, and then the inspired action, we are trying to create this platform. So when someone comes to talk to us, the conversation is strewn with triggers, different ideas, what all we have done, the imagery and all of that, where they can come and visualize themselves actually contributing to this. And BeForest becomes an easy avenue to participate.
Right. But it's also a lot operations intensive, right? I mean, there's a whole bunch that happens because, you know, you come up with a concept, you screen for people who could be relevant for the collective, and then a bunch of random people, I won't say random, but a bunch of people who don't really know each other all that well, come together to form an LLP, and then you purchase the land, and then everything else happens, probably 20, 30 other things that happen. It just seems like such a super difficult thing to do, you know? So I'm continuously surprised by how you've been able to do it.
While most people actually go into the legality of how things work, the paperwork, the LLP bit that you're talking about, I am myself constantly surprised at how many people I have met in these conversations who have no idea how the title in their apartment belongs to them. Is it divided, undivided ownership? There are enough number of people I've met who have been living in apartment buildings and the title actually doesn't even belong to them even today. You know, blissfully unaware of it. But having said that, you're right. I mean, most people who have ever bought agriculture land believe in the process of complete due diligence. I think those basic sanity checks we do really well. We have not compromised on that. Whenever we are entering into an acquisition of land, we make sure that there is a full due diligence process done by a respected legal company, given a written legal opinion, both on the title of the land as well as a structure note also about why this LLP structure makes most sense. It's not always LLP again. So depending on the state, the rules, all of that. So when we explain this to a person, that when someone asks what is an LLP and we tell them why we have gone the LLP way versus, let's say, a society or a specific trust or something like that, it sort of tells them that we have really done a lot of research and we understand what we are talking about. And I think that is also a big trust creating factor. Yes, you're right. A lot of people say no, even after being convinced about the idea, they still say no because it's just strange to be call some stranger a partner. But see, the way it's working for us is every time we convince one person, they bring 3-4 other people along with them. And everyone wants to, all of us who are, you know, anybody who's north of 35 has definitely discussed this idea with his closest friends that, hey, you know, one day we'll all buy this farm or home in the hills or something like that, right? So those 3-4 people come together over here. And of course, I mean, I think the background that we are coming from definitely helps. They know that we are not real estate people. We are not talking about plans. I think everything about us screams non-real estate. When someone asks us, what about due diligence? We actually share all our documentation. We tell them, you know, this is the entire set. These are the lawyers who you can always have a conference call with them. So we are extremely transparent. When we don't know something, we say we don't know. All we can say is, you know what, if shit hits the fan, we are on your side as well. And you have to believe me. There are always early adopters. So it's not like everyone comes forward at the same time. There are those who are early adopters who are willing to take that leap of faith. But we've had conversations that have gone on for 2 years and one fine day they came forward and said, you know what, I want to be a part of this collective. And there have been conversations where we went to meet someone else, this guy overheard us and he said, okay, even I want to be a part. So single day conversions as well as 2 year, 3 year conversations also. So I guess it depends on where a different consumer comes in, early adopter or, you know, laggard, or when do they want to come in.
Right. And you know, you talk about maintaining the ecological and economic balance, right? I mean, you're not just building homes for people to stay, but you're also building a lifestyle, right? You know, the houses can be rented out. I mean, there is the whole Be Wild angle to it where, you know, you're producing coffee and maybe you'll produce something else, pepper or whatever else later. You know, how do you balance both of these elements and why was it important to do that? Because you could have just, you know, sold a bunch of homes to people, right?
Yes, two aspects to that. One is the home actually came up as an afterthought because when we started talking about just a collective, we got a lot of speculative investor queries that I want to buy now, sell 6 months later or something like that. And we came into the scene at the peak of a bull run also. Like 2018 in Hyderabad was, you know, almost the entire state was playing the real estate game. Especially in farmland. So we came in at that time and we got a lot of speculator interest. So we thought adding a home to the process sort of attaches people to this idea. And they're not just looking at it as some investment asset class, but rather thinking they have their dreams attached to it. They're thinking about it every day. So that's how this whole angle of homes came in. And the moment we thought of doing something, we're always doing it really in a very sustainable way and all of that. So that's how the whole home angle came in. But the idea of ecological and economic balance went through a major evolution in our minds. Initially, it was all about striking the balance. I told you we came from a place where, we didn't want ecological conservation to be a charity-based thing. We wanted it to have a viable business model behind it. But as we started understanding sustainability and the definition broadened for us, we realized over time that, if you look at things from a generational point of view, they are actually the same. They will merge at some point. You can't have one without the other. That's what we've realized. And incidentally, we are living in a time where, what we have always assumed to be free is not anymore. There are enough examples. I'm not sure whether it's happened in Bangalore and Bombay, but I've lived in Bombay where my apartment used to pull in 100 tankers a day. So water security is not something you can take for granted. And then almost every other, like when I grew up, this Hyderabad used to get water from a lake in the city. It went in, slowly we moved on to a river that was 50 kilometers away. Now we are pulling from Godavari, which is almost 200 kilometers away now. And so this increasing circle of resource grabbing, it sort of underlines that, the commons that we have assumed to be free all the time are not anymore. And when you start factoring in the cost of it, the cost of pure air or the cost of keeping a hillside intact, cost of recreating a forest or an aquifer and all of this, if you build it into the cost, you start realizing that you're thinking of the landscape as a self-contained thing because you're adding all the costs of revitalizing even the natural aspects of things. So that's what we are doing at BeForest, right? So we are creating this self-contained landscape. And without that, what happens is the economy also goes for a toss when one of the resources starts incurring a cost. And dairy is like a great example in our state. What we saw is, a lot of people started using grasslands and, you assume that fodder is free, but it's not. After a certain point in time, there is a cost of actually growing that fodder also. And the moment you hit that point, the dynamics change. Same thing, I met a lot of papaya farmers. There was an era where I met a lot of papaya farmers who used to sell 20, 25 acres of papaya farm earning crores of rupees. And then 6, 7 years later, you start thinking, when I talk to the same set of folks, they say, we don't plant it anymore because there's a pest infestation. So what is the cost of retaining that biodiversity? When you look at a 20, 25 year time period, ecology and economy are so intertwined. There are so many examples of companies ranging from, very small to multi-billion dollar corporations, which have taken very big hits because of ignorance on the ecological side. So I think there is enough documented and mathematical proof that they are both going into the same merging. It's like a shaking of hands. That's been the change definition for us. So it's not like we're trying to balance two things. They are the same for us now.
Yeah. No, it's a great point. I think you have to look at it holistically. And to that end, your concept of natural capital seems very relevant, right? Where you factor in the value of everything around you, whether it's air, water, land, etc. This Be Wild business, right? Where you're selling coffee and produce, essentially. How did that come about? And, are you planning to add more products? And what is it like running a D2C business? Because that is effectively what it is, right?
Yes, it is. So Be Wild came up because of a need that, because we are growing natural and wild produce. And, one of the important premises is that a farm can be viable as well, while being ecologically sustainable. And so how do we do this? We've tried different aspects. We've tried growing a lot and selling in the market, but that's always a slippery slope. And even if you're maintaining all your ecological parameters, you're maintaining your soil moisture, soil carbon, and all of that, there will always be a once in 5-6 years down cycle where, the prices drop dramatically or there's a pest infestation. Something happens and you're knocked out. So we felt like you had to be a lot more resilient than that. So, and permaculture in itself is very resilient in the sense you have a lot of diversity of produce. But we wanted to do it without putting pressure on the land to grow more. So growing more to break even was not an option for us. We wanted to grow as much as the land allows. Now, what did we do was, how do we go up the value chain then? Do we sell to the supermarkets? Do we sell export stuff? Or the exporting, again, we ruled it out because our entire premise is, you know, go local and, you know, your needs and supplies have to ripple out. Eat first and whatever is left is what you sell to your neighbor and then so on. So exporting was like the last choice. So one, after all these experiments, what we really realized is the place of maximum value addition is when a consumer is subscribing to you. He's buying it from you directly without anyone in the middle and not via a supermarket. And supermarkets were a big disappointment for us, to be honest. But yeah, when someone tries to buy it directly from you, and that can only happen if there is a trust network, and we didn't have the certificates to start off with. You know, you can't, in the first year of operation itself, you can't just say you're Rainforest Alliance certified and organic and all of that. So how do we do this is, we saw that we had BeForest, where a lot of people had actually placed their trust in us. And these, it is like their farm. This is actually produced from their farm. How about, and this is a community of 200 people who have subscribed to this idea, and 200 have come from a larger set of, you know, 1,000, 2,000 people whom we've had conversations with. So all of these people actually on some level trust BeForest. So why don't we tell them, reach out to them and say that, you know what, you guys know how we grow things, but here is what has grown. So do you want to buy it? And we've now not priced it premium or anything. Exactly what you buy in the market, we priced it at the same. And we've done a lot of trial runs of different produce. Although coffee is what is there on our website, we've sold rice, we've sold custard apples, we've sold turmeric, pepper, on much smaller scale. And what we realized is, very often our farms, the amount of yield that is coming right now, most of the produce goes away in about 3-4 days every time it comes, because it's a little throughout the year. So coffee was one thing which is an annual produce, and we realized we wanted to, it's not, you can't sell a little bit of it every day. So it has, we have to build a brand around it. So that's when we went beyond just filter coffee. We tied up with a couple of roasters, tried to get different variants, and that's how the Be Wild coffee got launched. But soon we'll be adding a lot of other produce. Our ultimate aim is to actually provide everything that is there in the kitchen. Any edible item in the kitchen needs to be wild and natural, at least for the community members.
Yeah, so that would be truly sustainable in that sense.
And it's remarkable because when we calculated the natural capital that we earn by actually growing this Be Wild coffee from Pumale Collective Coorg, we realized that we are actually saving almost 65 liters of water for every half a kilo bag, which was 130 liters per kilo of water. And that means that, you know, every 4 kilos is actually giving a family in Bangalore one day's worth of drinking water. And such a small 128-acre estate having that kind of impact. Imagine if, like, you know, that entire area adopts similar processes.
Amazing. You've done some fantastic things in the last, you know, 3 to 4 years. But what do you have coming up next? You know, I mean, how do you plan to scale from 3 to, let's say, 100 collectives? Or will you scale to 100 collectives?
So that's a very interesting question. We would love to do 100 collectives, but we have a lot of incoming interest with people with a lot of land asking us to set up collectives in the area and stuff like that. But, you know, we don't want to make promises before we can actually deliver. And you mentioned throughout this conversation that there are no precedents for something like this, right? So it's not like I can give an Excel sheet calculation that, you know, if you have 100 acres, this is what you're going to make at the end of it. So, but at the same time, we feel it's not fair for someone with 100 acres to just give us the land to experiment on in this day and age. So what we want to do is focus on these collectives, and at least till one of them reaches full execution, showcase what all can be achieved. And we are very close to that in terms of Pumale Collective. And maybe once, as soon as we are done, we are exploring a lot of very interesting opportunities in both Karnataka in the coffee growing belt, as well as central India in Madhya Pradesh, in and around the tiger landscape, basically. We are also looking at really interesting opportunities in Telangana region also. Now, which one will we pick up is really debatable, but yeah, I think our immediate goal really is to go to maybe about 10 collectives over the next 3 years. And after that, it's going to be a mix of our own collectives and managed land estates, where, you know, once a prototype is proven and we have some kind of benchmarks that, you know, this much productivity can be achieved, then we can have these large land bank owners and we can suggest how they can change their lands and manage their place for them and so on. Now, an interesting thing, because we are talking about returns, I thought I should mention that we've come up with this really interesting framework. We've adapted the Common Lands Four Returns framework, which sort of quantifies returns along four different axes. The financial return is something we always understand. And then there is the natural capital return, social capital, and a return of inspiration. And this framework allows us to actually boil it down to numbers. So it's not always rupees, but at least you can quantifiably say that you've actually inspired people in and around that community to actually take this up with a sense of purpose. How much social capital have you created in terms of bringing back jobs to the area, the diversity in skill set opportunities, all of that. So this framework sort of helps us quantify. And one really interesting learning we've had by trying to put our returns into these four parameters is that in most cases we've noticed that inspiration returns come first and financial returns come last. And that progression from inspiration to, you know, once a sense of purpose comes, a lot of people, a collective mindset sort of comes up, which is basically what we call, in other words, an idea whose time has come. A lot of people are thinking of the same thing. That's what we refer to as that social capital, right? And then the solution to it is to create a lot of natural capital, which sort of creates the resources to gain financial capital. So that progression, we always thought it will be the other way around when we started doing it, but it turns out it's inspiration first.
So what is your advice on building a niche community, which is, you know, essentially what the collective is, right? I mean, you've tapped into an underlying feeling or a sentiment that, you know, an enough number of people have, and you've identified that core culture to kind of build this product out, right? Or build this community out. So what is, you know, your advice to people who are attempting to do something similar?
Because you're talking about a niche community, I feel what works best is what I often refer to as the art of the unsell, which is, you know, when you're trying to talk and bring people into your collective, don't try to go overboard, because you'll tend to overpromise things, especially in areas which are being defined now. So what you need to do is really very transparently tell things as they are. And if there is enough value, people will come forward, because transparency is, you know, it's a great currency to have. Creates a lot of trust, and that's so rare. That when you're putting things very authentically and you come across with very, I don't know is I don't know. Don't try to sugarcoat as, you know, I know this, we are the experts, we know how to handle it and all of that. So when you come across with this value system that you can bring to the table and you're truly authentic about it, I think the people who are experiencing this felt need will find you. There have been cases, of course, where we were not able to create the community also. And in those cases, we have to be very detached and let the numbers do the job. In Bangalore, especially, our first experiment was in Bangalore. But when we tried to create a community, a collective in Bangalore, it didn't work. So when you have these thumb rules that, you know, I want my seed community to be in place, at least 25% of the collective has to adopt you before you start implementing it as a validation of you. This was one of the core principles we started off with. So when that doesn't happen, although I am desperate to do something in Bangalore, I'm very attached to the idea, the numbers are not lying. It doesn't mean you give up, but at least it's time to tweak your approach. You have to change something. Maybe it comes easily for me because I've always been a numbers based guy, but I'm also a very emotional and a very, I get attached to my ideas really strongly. So faith in your numbers, being very objective about it, it's a great skill set if you can develop it. And that will always, it's true, numbers don't lie. So they will always guide you in the right direction. So unsell and trust your numbers.
Right. One of the things that is fascinating to me is that you didn't use the lack of real estate experience as a handicap. I mean, you used that as your authentic self, right? And you went out and in fact, I mean, marketed that as a USP, which is really fascinating, actually. You know, people are increasingly more aware of sustainability. They want to do something to change the status quo. And, you know, your ideal is very inspirational, right? I mean, what you've done is really inspirational because you've showed that you can kind of balance for profit and for good, right? So what is your advice to, you know, young people out there who are listening, who want to do something in sustainability, but don't know, you know, what is that logical first step to take?
So, see, I think the basics are always the same. One is, you cannot, if you're going to the sustainability route, you can't accelerate nature. There are certain processes that have a gestation period. So you have to wait it out. So there's no point. You definitely should not fall prey to either peer pressure or, you know, especially because we have so many tech startups nowadays, it's easy to think we need to grow really fast. You don't need to do that. I think it's most important in this space to really understand your process and get it right the first time. The whole idea of, you know, fail fast and, you know, fail small still works here as well. It's just that everything is relative and it's in nature time scale. What might take 3 months might take a year instead. But that's something that you cannot have the pressure that you have to grow 3 times a 3x in every year or 10x and so on. You can't fall prey to that. I think that's a very clear understanding we have of the sustainability space. The second thing is what happens often in this space, what we have noticed is we understand very little about a natural process, but we are probably at the tip of the iceberg, as we say. So very often there's a tendency to use that as an excuse and just make it a subjective call when it doesn't have to be. And what we've realized now in the last 4 years is a lot of these natural processes can actually be quantified. There are nice frameworks, well tried out experiments which can guide you, which can make it a much more sensible guess of a process rather than, you know, you don't have to just try and fail and try and fail. There is a way to do things also. It may not be like a lab where, you know, 1 + 1 is always 2, but there are enough frameworks to actually quantify what you're doing. And if you do a bit of a research, you'll realize that. And we are all, anybody who's listening to this also can always reach out and we can guide them. Because I have personally felt that the greatest value we have added as a company is to make frameworks out of this entire process, you know, of sustainability and sustainable farming especially.
Right. Any books or podcasts that you would recommend?
I would definitely recommend everyone to watch A Little Big Farm, which is on Netflix. So just to get a real understanding of what a farm is like, because for me, it was a very rude awakening from the romanticism of the idea of a farm to actually owning a farm. But if someone's really wanting to dig deep, one book that has really changed me, it's nothing to do with farming, but Founders at Work, I think, was a great book that almost everyone who wants to start up has to read. It can be a little verbose, but I think it's a very authentic take from founders about what their biggest challenges were. So it really helps.
Fantastic. That's a great note to end the podcast on, Sunit. This was a fascinating conversation. Thank you again for making the time.
Thank you, Roshan. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you liked this episode, then don't forget to subscribe to us on your favorite platform. And share this episode with all of your fellow startup operators. Also, follow the Startup Operator on LinkedIn and Twitter for more updates. Stay safe, take care, and see you soon on a brand new episode of the Startup Operator.